Okay, if you're ready to proceed, we have the podium at the right level. We'll start the clock.
May it please the court, Your Honors. Robert Koch on behalf of the state of Oregon. This case is about the separation of powers. In In re U.S. Department of Education, this court delineated three required elements before a district court can order the deposition of a high-level executive branch official. In doing so, the court emphasized repeatedly that the foundation for the test was constitutional. It safeguards intrusion by the judicial branch into the upper levels of the executive branch. Here, the district court correctly believed itself bound by that legal standard, but the court clearly erred in applying it. It ordered the deposition of the former governor of the state of Oregon, despite none of the three required elements being present. The state of Oregon thus asked this court to issue a writ of mandamus and quash the district court's unlawful deposition order. In Department of Education, the court, the court established three required elements to order such a high-level executive branch deposition. First, there must be a finding of bad faith. The information sought must be essential to the case, and the information sought cannot be obtained in any other way. None of those three elements is present here. With respect to bad faith, the courts typically look to see whether there's been a change in agency position or a conflict between agency action and agency positions, or whether the action taken was done outside of the official typical channels. Here, the district court made no such finding. All the court did was look at plaintiff's allegations. There was actually no finding ever made by the district court, which is what this court requires. And ultimately, what resulted was the district court had a policy disagreement with the actions that the governor took. Early in the pandemic, the district court recommended that the governor use her clemency powers to widespread release adults in custody to allow for more social distancing in the prisons. And the district court ultimately didn't think that the governor did enough. But that's not what this court requires. There needs to be some type of bad faith, some type of change in agency position that warrants intrusion by the judicial branch into the decision-making processes of the executive branch.
Mr. Koch, I don't want to interrupt the flow of your argument, but I wanted to let you know the issue that's on my mind so you could address it at some point. The Department of Education case that you cite, that involves the standard for when a federal official can be deposed, right? And in this case, we're dealing with a state official, very high-level governor, because it's the governor, but it's a state official. So was there any settled law as to the standard for when a state official could be deposed, and the standard for that? Because if there was not settled law, what bothers me is how can there be clear error if the standard is not settled by precedent?
Your Honor, we believe it was settled by precedent, specifically the Department of Education case. Factually, that case involved the deposition of a federal agency, of a cabinet official. But the legal principles this court made clear had nothing to do with that fact. It had to do with the constitutional principles of separation of powers, which apply equally between the federal executive and the federal judiciary, but also the federal judiciary and the state executive, between the federal and state balance. And the district court recognized as much below.
There's a term for that. It's called our federalism.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so that those federalism principles are inherent in our constitutional design, which is why the district court recognized that there was no legal justification to differentiate between federal and state officials. And plaintiffs even conceded below that no court in this country had ever differentiated between federal and state officials with respect to the legal standard that requires that the legal standard that applies before you can order such a high-level executive branch deposition.
Well, your complaint is not with the applicable law, but with the application to your particular potential deponent, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I know you've made arguments about whether they exhausted and other avenues, but is the key question comes down really to the bad faith in your view? Is that?
I mean, certainly, Your Honor, that's one of the three, but frankly, we don't think any of the three factors were satisfied here remotely. Mm-hmm. And so in Department of Education, the court made clear that all three have to be present before you can order such a deposition.
And it has to be, for us to overturn this, has to be clear error, correct?
Yes, well, not necessarily, Your Honor, because in Department of Education, this court had not yet announced the legal standard for such depositions. The court still issued a writ of mandamus and quashed the deposition order because of the grave separation of powers principles that are at stake in cases such as this. And so towards the end of the Department of Education opinion, the court looked through the five Bauman mandamus factors and really focused on, I believe it was the last one, which is, does the case involve something so important that it warrants exercise of mandamus by this court? And given the separation of powers principles, when you order the deposition of a high-level executive branch official, the court said that, yes, that is worthy of this court's exercise of mandamus.
Can you tell me, I don't know if you all have done the calculation, but when Governor Brown was governor, how many times was she sued?
That's a great question. She sued a lot.
How many times? I honestly... Dozens? Hundreds?
I'll be honest, Your Honor, I don't know. Our trial level folks, I'm in the appellate division, so
You don't deal with facts.
So I do know it happens often, and it happens often in the Eighth Amendment context. And so that's partly what's striking here, where there was no finding of bad faith. All the district court did was look at the nature of the allegations. And the governor gets sued a lot.
I mean, I think this is a matter of judicial. Would it be possible for you all to provide us by 28J just an indication of how many times the governor was sued when she was governor? Just a list, just a number. I don't mean identification, but the number of cases.
Sure. For under any legal claim,
or like any legal claim. Okay. Any legal claim.
I will certainly endeavor to do that. Yeah, if that would be helpful to the court, we are happy to
very
look into that.
To know how many times the governor was sued, so that if we allow this, how many times is a former a governor when they're thinking about their decision making? To what extent do they have to think? Oh, right. Okay. Not only am I, when I leave, it's maybe even now, but maybe when I leave office, I may end up in dozens of hundreds of depositions based upon the decisions I make as governor. So I'd be curious to know how many times the governor was sued in the course of her, while she was an incumbent governor.
And then we were happy to look into that. I think it's important to note that the Department of Education decision itself quantification certainly informs the decision making, but it's
but
not
any single
lawsuit.
The
threat of having to sit for a deposition is an intrusion into the separation of powers, even in just a single case.
An interim effect.
Yeah.
But the bad faith, there's kind of a fine line between accepting the nature of the allegations and then getting into them, which goes into the merits. So what would you have expected the district court to do?
Well, I think what I would have expected the district court to do is do what other courts have done, which is, has there been a change in agency position? Was there action taken that was done outside of the normal channels? And the reason why other courts have undertaken that type of inquiry, because whenever there's official, because it's important to keep in mind the governor here was sued for official state action. Whenever official action, state or federal, is taken, there's a record of that decision making. There is that, to the extent that an individual plaintiff wants to know an answer as to why something happened, there's a record of it. Or if there's not an official record, depositions can happen. And so in this case, plaintiffs seek to depose the governor over the exercise of her clemency powers, which is constitutional in Oregon. And they also want to ask about the closure of two state prisons, which she recommended. The record indicates what the governor's thinking was. On clemency, it's at addendum pages 171 and 296. On the prison closures, it's at addendum 148 to 155. As best we can tell, plaintiffs just don't like the answer. And so there's no indication that the answers that were given via public record and via the depositions, that's the explanation for the state action. And so typically when other courts have found bad faith, and this includes the D.C. Circuit case that plaintiffs cited in their 28J letter, there was changing agency positions. The agency said one thing, a different person in the agency said another thing. In that case, DOJ ended up doing something different. There were three different reasons that were given for a particular action. And so I think Department of Education is instructive in that regard as well. In that case, the Department of Education gave one explanation for why there was a delay in processing borrowing requests. And then they did something completely different that indicated that the two things conflicted. And so when we say bad faith, that's typically what courts have looked at. And there's just no evidence of that here, which is why we suspect that the district court never looked at it.
So your argument that, well, here's the policy, that's what she did, cut and dried. But it does seem to me that there's texture behind that that may go to the nature of the why and the justification and all of that, that she would be uniquely qualified to talk about, that you can't get from the piece of paper.
That's
why isn't that saying, you know, you can't, if you have the piece of paper and you've exhausted your other discovery, your interrogatory route, you still need to talk to the witness.
Well, I think that's where the three factors really interplay with each other, because they didn't exhaust. They exhausted discovery, but they did not exhaust discovery on this topic. They never asked directed questions to the governor's staff and their, well, first of all, they deposed her chief of staff at the beginning of the pandemic. They asked no specific questions on either of these two topics, period. And so and then they didn't depose at all her chief of staff for most of the pandemic. In December of 2020, the deputy chief of staff became the chief of staff. They never deposed her. And so that's partly why this court requires exhaustion of discovery, because hypothetically, there may have been those depositions may have given different answers, which would then be an indication of bad faith, but they never did that here.
We're cutting close to your time, but I have one quick question. As I understand your theory, we also should decide, among other things, that because this claim fails to state a claim as a matter of law, that even if the district court decided otherwise, that that this deposition is not necessary.
So
we would have to decide that. I mean, that's one of the things we, in other words, if putting all other things being equal, mm-hmm. if this claim failed to state a claim as a matter of law, we would say that the deposition wasn't necessary.
That's correct, Your Honor. So we think the court can decide it. It doesn't necessarily have to. We do think it's squarely presented, because
there's some circuits that do that, right?
That's correct. And there are, because part one of the three required elements is that the sought after information be essential to the case. The information they want does not support a valid claim for relief under the Eighth Amendment, and so that's it's just per se not essential then under this court's legal standard.
I know you're getting to the end of your time, and I'm sure our presiding judge will be a little flexible, but I want to zero in on the question of, I guess you call it exhaustion, where the magistrate judge is saying that, okay, now we're at the end of discovery. We denied the deposition before. We said go out and take discovery. And so then the magistrate judge says, well, they served the interrogatories. They talked to some of her staff members. But none of these discovery members have provided plaintiffs with all the information they require about what she knew about the heightened risk of COVID, and particularly with respect to population density and prison closures. Where did the magistrate go wrong, if at all, in that conclusion?
The magistrate judge went wrong because plaintiffs never asked the question. And so, the magistrate judge ignored that plaintiffs didn't depose the governor's chief of staff for most of the pandemic, and typically staff deposition. And it's well recognized, or in these circumstances, that the chief of staff is sort of ran the ship in the governor's office. And so that would have been the staff member that you would first depose. And so the magistrate judge ignored that. The magistrate judge also ignored the fact that for the chief of staff that and the other staff members that plaintiffs did depose, they never asked directed questions at what they now want to depose the governor on. And in their briefing, they didn't identify those questions that went unanswered. And so it's hard for me to point to a negative, and I can't, it's in the record, but it's a little unclear. It wasn't until plaintiff's answering brief that we got full clarity as to what they actually wanted to depose the governor on, which is her clemency decision-making and the prison closures. As to those, we're still not exactly sure what specific questions they want to ask the governor, because they didn't ask staff members anything more particular that didn't get answered. And so that, in our view, the magistrate judge was like, okay, discovery closed, interrogatories were issued, depositions happened. But that's not enough, in our view. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Same, Mr. Coach, just for your planning purposes, although you used up all your time, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. And Counsel for Manet, one extra time, we'll add that to your.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Nadia Dahab, on behalf of Paul Maney and the other real parties in interest, on behalf of plaintiffs and the certified class. The district court in this case ruled that extraordinary circumstances existed to warrant a 2-hour deposition of former Oregon Governor Kate Brown, who is a named defendant in this 1983 class action case. That ruling was not clearly erroneous for a couple of reasons. First, neither this court nor the Supreme Court has ever addressed the deposition privilege in the context of a high-level state official. In the absence of such authority, there was no clear error by the district court here. Second, virtually every other circuit court to have addressed this question has applied a standard consistent with or below the standard the district court applied in this case. Applying those authorities here, there was also no clear error. Additionally, Governor Brown below in the district court never raised bad faith, the argument she now makes on appeal, until the hearing on the motion to compel and the motion for protective order. It's difficult to understand how an argument that was not affirmatively raised by the governor in the district court could now give rise to clear error on appeal.
But she did raise that, correct?
When would she raise it?
In the motion to compel?
In the district court, there was a motion to compel the deposition of Governor Brown and a responsive motion for protective order.
Correct.
To prohibit it. Neither of those motions raised bad faith, raised the standard set forth in In re Department of Education as the standard that should apply, bad faith, the standard that should apply in these circumstances. The district court raised the question at the hearing on the motion to compel and ultimately applied that standard in this case. But an argument that neither parties affirmatively raised in the papers and only discussed at the hearing, it's difficult to see how that then can turn around and be clear error on appeal. The standard in plaintiff's view that should apply to this case is that the state-level official, here Governor Brown, had firsthand personal knowledge of the information that plaintiffs seek. Two, that the information sought was relevant and essential to the claims. And three, that it cannot be reasonably obtained from other alternative sources. Those three elements are the elements that other circuits, this court again has never addressed this question, that other circuits have applied to determine whether extraordinary circumstances exist to depose a high-level state or local official.
Well, the DeVos, or I guess we're calling it Department of Education case, the district court invoked that standard, correct?
It did.
And
yes.
The state doesn't quibble with the standard, as I understand it, but with the application of the standard.
That's correct.
All right.
Yes.
So we don't need to argue about that. I guess the question I have is, what is the precise information that you would seek from the former governor, and was that same inquiry made of high-level staff, such as the chief of staff?
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. So I want to step back a little bit because this case is not only about the clemency decisions or the early release decisions that Governor Brown did or did not make. It is although along with her decision to close two prison facilities during the pandemic are two of the primary topics on which plaintiffs seek information. They seek that information in the context of their deliberate indifference 1983 claims against her and other high-level state officials. And we've made this clear in the motion to compel in the district court that it's that information, along with other information the governor may have known about the ability to socially distance in the custodial setting, the noncompliance, as it were, in this case, widespread across prison facilities with respect to masking and social distancing.
Just to try to unpack it, you said, well, there's clemency and there's the prison closures, but then there's a bunch of other stuff. So what is that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's really what she knew in terms of the ability of adults in custody to safely protect themselves from COVID and her decisions.
Was that specific information asked in an interrogatory and also in the deposition of the chief of staff or the precursor person to the deputy chief of staff?
We deposed one of the chiefs of staff. That we did not depose the chief of staff in the second part of the pandemic because the crucial decisions, at least in plaintiff's view, were made by the governor the first year of the pandemic. So we deposed the chief of staff at that time and asked him questions, and all of these questions are at addendum 251 and 252 in the record on appeal, about what she knew and what factors she considered, for instance, in her decisions to close two institutions. We also asked that question of the governor's public.
Why wasn't that sufficient, that the answer you received there?
The answer was, I don't recall. He did not know the answers to the questions. We also asked the governor's public safety advisor, and we determined who to ask these questions by a third deposition that we took to understand the flow of information in the governor's office and who would be most likely to have the information that plaintiffs sought. And so through that deposition, we deposed her public safety advisor, who's her primary liaison to the Department of Corrections, her chief of staff, and then later, actually at the time that this mandamus proceeding was being briefed, her special projects attorney, who was the liaison to the Department of Corrections on the early release process. So we deposed all three of those people and got a lot of, frankly, I don't knows and I don't recalls about her decisions, you know, whether she knew about the widespread mask noncompliance in the Department of Corrections, whether she knew whether AICs could socially distance, whether the governors or the DOC ever asked the legislature for more funds to use mothballed facilities to house AICs. And then in the light of all of that information, what she considered or what she was thinking when she decided to shut down two institutions and other decisions, other, you know, decisions she made with respect to population reduction.
And were the interrogatory answers similarly unilluminating?
We used the interrogatories. I want to be careful with this because we used the interrogatories to seek to better understand the policy decisions that the governor's office made and who would be best suited to give us information about those policy decisions. We did not propound on the governor all the questions that we would have asked her in a deposition through interrogatories. And frankly, if that were necessary, then no one would ever be able to depose a high-level state official. And we think that one, we did not have the obligation to exhaust all possible discovery devices, no matter how effective they, you know, or ineffective they may be, but believed, I think reasonably so, that interrogatories were not a reasonable alternative source of the information that we really seek here.
Let me ask you this question. Why do you need this information if, in fact, you fail to state a claim? Right. So do you, or would you agree that if assuming for, I'm not, you don't have to concede that you obviously failed to state a claim, but assuming for purposes of argument that you failed to state a claim, is there any need for this information?
You know, it's a fair question. I think that if the claim was insufficient from the start, then it would be difficult to seek a gubernatorial deposition seeking information about that claim. I will say a couple of things. First of all, the district court in this case has twice rejected the argument that the governor now seeks to have this court decide in a mandamus proceeding, which is plaintiff's state's claim for relief. That's a specific quote from their reply brief. And I don't think the Governor Brown can backdoor a Rule 12 argument into a mandamus proceeding. The district court denied their Rule 12 motion and denied the same arguments.
Why would we have to decide that if, in fact, you don't need it, if, in fact, you fail to state a claim? It seems to me that is part and parcel of what we have to decide.
You know, I don't think it is, Your Honor. First of all, like I said, I think the district court has twice rejected that argument. I don't think that that's
I know, but we're here reviewing the district court's decision, so that's not argument from authority.
But I'll push back on that and say that we're not reviewing any district court decision on the merits here. We're reviewing a discovery decision on mandamus for clear error.
Right, but it's intertwined with that. And it's intertwined with the elements of the test, presumably, if it's not necessary. The question is whether it's necessary. And if not, if you fail to state a claim, then I don't see how it's necessary.
I think the more fundamental problem, I think, with Governor Brown's argument that we failed to state a claim, it is that it's based squarely on her argument that clemency decisions or early release decisions are not subject to judicial review. That is not solely the basis of our claim. Our claim is based on a lot of other information, a lot of other actions and inactions the governor took or did not take over the course of the pandemic. It is not solely based on her decision, you know, not to release X number of people from the prison population to achieve social distancing. That's not the basis of the claim. The claim is that she was deliberately indifferent in taking certain actions and inactions, in closing prison facilities, in not directing not seeking additional funding to open up mothballed facilities to create social distancing, knowing that mass noncompliance was widespread, the rate of death in the Oregon Department of Corrections was many times that of the general population, and that social distancing cannot simply be achieved in the custodial setting. So she had, presumably, we don't know, knew all of this information, yet still made certain actions and inactions.
And this, what is the relief you all are seeking in this class action?
Damages.
Damages. And so, and can you explain the damages? Like, is it that somebody got COVID that they shouldn't have gotten COVID, and therefore, so everybody who actually got COVID is a class member? So, I mean, I'm just not understanding the damages theory here.
These are 1983 claims.
I know it's 1983, but
There's a certified class of about 5,000 adults in custody who contracted COVID, right, with varying levels of symptoms and hospitalization. And about 40-odd people, the estates of 40-odd people who died in Department of Corrections custody, and the state law wrongful death statute provides for damages for those claims. So that's the claims that we're seeking below. I want to, if the court will allow, briefly address the bad faith argument, because I think that that's a, I heard the panel say that that's a particular concern of the arguments in this case, and so I want to make sure that our position on that is clear. And that is, I think, In re Department of Education and the other cases that address the deposition privilege in the context of an agency head or a federal agency staff member, that those all arise in the context of agency proceedings. And I think, you know, Governor Round's counsel talked about the need to show a change in agency position or an irregularity in agency action. And I think that description is telling because it shows how specific the bad faith requirement is to the Administrative Procedures Act and to to a request for extra record discovery in the context of an administrative proceeding. That's where bad faith comes into play, and that's the genesis of the bad faith requirement. Applying that requirement here just doesn't make sense. Bad faith, I think, this court described it in the Betsy DeVos case, is dishonesty. It's improper litigation behavior. And I think that is the kind of thing that is more appropriate when you're reviewing an agency record or an agency proceeding than it is.
You're just telling us that we should treat the governor of a sovereign state and just treat them like they're the CEO of a company?
No, I don't want to suggest that we are running from our federalism concerns that I think are real when it comes to the relationship between the federal courts and the state and the federal governments and the state.
Aren't they just as weighty as it seems to me they're just as weighty as the separation of powers issues. You know, we have the horizontal separation of powers, and then we have vertical federalism. And it seems to me those are equally weighty.
I think they are both important. In this context, I mean, we have one, the Supremacy Clause, which I think allows the supreme federal constitutional rights of that are being pursued in this case to be fully pursued and to overcome that of state action. And we have a congressional, we have 1983. Congress has said that individuals can pursue federal constitutional violations against state officials.
Right, and there's some there are exceptions to that, like Younger versus Harris, right? That's where our federalism comes from, is Younger versus Harris. And we don't just have, there's not carte blanche, and the federal judiciary exercises restraint when we tread upon sensitive issues of federalism, and Younger versus Harris is one example of that. And it just seems to me that these issues are equally weighty, and that would be, you know, we often apply a body of law from one area to another that's analogous because it's a body of law that's settled and it's understandable, and you apply the same principles, and you then have a predictable rule of decision. And there's something to be said for doing that here. We have a predictable rule of decision for senior, for cabinet-level officials and the chief executive officer of a state.
I don't want to run from the importance of the separation of powers of the federalism principles. I don't think no case has said that those principles foreclose these depositions altogether.
But what's a little unclear to me is, you know, we're here on mandamus, we're here on clear error review, but now you seem to be running away from the determination of bad faith and saying it's not necessary. But that, of course, was one of the prongs that the district court addressed.
Sure, yes. I want to be clear. I think that there was no authority here, and there's no authority from this court or the Supreme Court or any other circuit. And I think on clear error review, that means the district court did not clearly err.
Well, the state agrees that you could apply DeVos, Department of Education. It has bad faith as a component. So you could say, of course, there's no clear error in the law, but what about the application of the law? And that's, to me, the rub that you haven't quite addressed. You're basically arguing that the good faith standard shouldn't apply here, right?
The
bad faith standard should not apply.
We're arguing that the district court properly concluded that plaintiff's allegations of deliberate indifference, the essentiality of the information that they sought to their claims, the governor's firsthand knowledge in the terms of decisions that she made, and the fact that we've exhausted all other reasonable alternative sources of discovery means that this that extraordinary circumstances warranted her deposition.
I'm going to ask one more time and see if you'll answer my question more precisely. Are you taking the position that bad faith is not a necessary element here in terms of benchmarking taking of the deposition?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we are.
Even and the district court imposed that requirement.
The district court imposed that requirement. I think she didn't make a finding of bad faith because she found that the court found that the allegations of improper of deliberate indifference were sort of different from but likened to that standard. We don't think the district court, in applying the test that she applied, clearly erred.
Yes, counsel, I know you're over your time. Mr. Coach went over his also, so I'm going to ask you another question.
Okay.
If we were reviewing the district court decision and then you were adopting a standard different from the one the district court used, I could see that would be fairly simple reason to say the district court erred and we have to vacate and remand. But in this case, we're dealing with not with the review of the district court decision, but with a petition for a writ of mandamus. And, you know, that requires a clear error having been made. So I'm still struggling with the idea that even though federalism may be as weighty as separation of power, still, if we have no law on the subject, I don't see how we can have a clear error. And is that part of your position?
Yes, that is our argument, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Cooch. Now, we're giving you 2 minutes beyond your depleted time. So,
thank you, Your Honors. A few quick points. So, about each of the three elements. So, as to bad faith, the district court thought bad faith was required, and the court considered itself bound by this court's decision in Department of Education, which was correct. Plaintiffs argue that we didn't raise bad faith in the pleadings. That's just incorrect. If you look at addendum pages 112, 113, and 121, we cited Department of Education, and we argue that the governor had not acted with an improper motive or outside the scope of normal channels. And
Where was that cited? What are you citing to there? Is that
the addendum, which was attached to our petition, which is the sort
right,
of...
I'm sorry, but is that the... In the district court, was that the response to the... that was your motion for protective order?
Correct. Correct, Your Honor. Plaintiffs argue that the bad faith requirement comes from the APA, but I would draw this court's attention to footnotes 1 and 2 of Department of Education, where the court emphasized repeatedly that the three elements were constitutional due to the separation of powers. As to whether the Judge Gould, you asked about clear error, and I think I would also draw the court back to Department of Education. There was no Ninth Circuit decision squarely on point, but the legal principles were there, and this court found that the district court had therefore clearly erred. And also, given this specific context, when you're trying to depose a high-level executive branch official, here the governor of a sovereign state, the interests there are so important that it warrants exercise of mandamus. In terms of exhaustion, plaintiffs have never pointed to specific questions and interrogatories. They actually conceded an argument they didn't think they had to, but that's not what this court requires. And as for essential, we think it's squarely before the court whether they state a claim under the Eighth Amendment. The court doesn't have to reach it, but Department of Education went through each of the three factors. We think the information here is not essential because it's not relevant to their Eighth Amendment claim. We therefore ask that the court quash the deposition order. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Koch. Well, I want to thank counsel on both sides of this argument for their excellent advocacy. It's a very interesting question. We appreciate the advocates tutoring us on what you think is the correct result. As for what the correct result is, for us, we will see in time. Without further ado, the United States versus Mani is now submitted, and the parties will hear from us in due course. Thank you. That's, I think, our last case to be argued today. And so the court will now adjourn.